This and post it.
We're going to record it. You still say tape.
I do still say tape.
You're looking at my typewriter paper here and you're taping stuff, right?
Oh, leave me alone.
Do you still dial a phone?
I do. Okay, so let's introduce ourselves.
I'm Richard Remnick.
Co chair?
Oh, yes.
I need a name.
Joe.
Oh, sorry, Joe Dachshund.
Adams.
Mary Hamish.
I'm Richard Hirsch.
Mark Howard.
Sandy
Painter.
Jennifer
Hirsch.
Jennifer
Hirsch.
Jennifer
Hirsch.
Jennifer
Hirsch.
Jennifer
Hirsch.
Jennifer Hirsch.
Jennifer
Hirsch.
I'm just writing this down. It's my absolute worst thing in the rabbit and his names. But now I have a chart. Now you can't move your seats. Move your seats, I'm really absurd. So.
That would be evil.
Right?
That's Debbie.
Hi, Debbie. Okay. Thank you guys for coming out on that chilly night, but better than last night.
Yes.
And I called Marion this morning and said, just checking before I drive out, is the power on in the building, right? Because out by us, there's, you know, we live in Wynwood, and we're actually right near Rabbi Potemkin. Our neighborhood is kind of spotty. So I figured it was just better to check before we got here. Anyway, it's nice to be back at Beth Israel. I missed last year.
Yeah, missed you.
I've been. Thank you. I've been here. I missed you guys. I've been here pretty much, you know, once a spring usually, but last year was just too complicated. Mm. Working half time in two synagogues leaves you very little free time. This year I'm only working half time in one synagogue, so it was nice to get the invitation to be back. So I'm working at Makor Shalom in Cherry Hill. But it's only half time, so the drive, you know, 3 days a week, I don't mind that drive.
Yeah.
6 days a week, I would not mind that drive. Anyway. You know, when Mary and I were discussing topics for this year, I sent a whole list. And what you guys have and what Marion has that I never know is what else has been taught, you know, who else is teaching, what's already been covered, and what's too close to something else that's on the agenda this year. So a couple of things we knocked off, and we settled on this one that I'm calling Biblical and Rabbinic Responses to the Problem of Evil, but it's really Jewish responses. It's not going to stop with the Biblical and Rabbinic period. It's a three-week unit, so if you make all 3 weeks, that'll be great. If not, I think you have pretty much everything that we're going to cover in those 3 weeks here. Am I not coming through? Is that better?
Sure.
Okay. So, this is on?
Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe
I'll
like
it a little bit. Yep. I just have to lean over this way. It's like Passover. So if you don't make, you know, all three sessions, you can read through the material. It'll kind of take you through. So what I tried to do is organize the material by category of response of how the Jewish tradition has chosen in various ways in its official formulations to try to frame responses to the problem of evil. So it's usually helpful to explain why we have the problem as a good starting point, because it's not obvious, you know, to all religious traditions that the problem is equally defined. So, you know, in the category of there's good news and bad news, right? Monotheism is usually associated with the rise of the Jewish tradition. And it's one of the things that we kind of claim as one of our contributions to world culture. And there's lots to be said for monotheism, right? And there's one really big problem with it. When you get to the question of evil, if there's only one God in the entire, you know, creation and created universe, and that God's responsible in some way, direct or indirect, for everything that happens in the world, we have this problem that there's this thing that happens in life called bad things, which sometimes are personal, sometimes are collective, sometimes are medical, sometimes are, you know, related to climate and weather, like this year with hurricanes, for example, and trying to account for why those things happen in a world where there's only one God is what gives us the problem. So as a simple example, you know, when the Jews land in Babylonia in around 586, 560, before the Common Era, when the Jewish kingdom of Judea is destroyed by the Babylonians, they encounter a religion that we know or you may have heard of called Zoroastrianism. So Zoroastrianism is pretty close to Jewish tradition. It's almost monotheism, but it's got two gods. You know, the god in charge of good things and the god in charge of bad things. So, you know, if you took this adult ed class in a Zoroastrian congregation, you know, you wouldn't be, you know, it would be over in about 10 minutes, right? Because, you know, the answer is that's from the bad god, and the answer is that's from the good god. But in Jewish tradition, excuse me, I thought I turned my phone off. Either it's buzzing or someone's calling me from Bethlehem, PA. You know what this is? This is junk calls that have migrated to our cell phones.
Yeah, crazy. I'm getting junk texts.
Crazy. I mean, you start to recognize the numbers, right? I apologize, I've now turned that off. So in Jewish tradition, you know, basically the problem of evil has normally been framed the way it is in Western philosophy. And you probably remember this from high school or college, you know, philosophy 101 classes. You have three propositions that emerge over a period of time in Jewish thought and Christian thought, in Islamic thought, and in Western philosophy. Around monotheism. One is the proposition that God is all good. There's no evil in God. The second is the proposition that God is all powerful. And the third is the data that's irrefutable, which is there's real evil in the world. So one of those three things needs some analysis and adjustment to be able to make your way through the monotheistic morass of how you deal with problems of evil. And we'll see as we go through these sources that what gets adjusted in those three choices really varies from place to place and time to time, but it also varies across a continuum. So let me be less obscure about this. We could come at this purely as a kind of Reconstructionist exercise, like, what did they say in the Bible period about this? What did they say in the rabbinic period, the medieval period, the modern period, the contemporary period? That would be a kind of chronological analysis. What I chose to do was frame it more around concepts that Jewish tradition has used in various times and places, but it's also sort of chronological within the concept. So you'll see that as we go through this. So to dial all the way back on page one here of my handout, so you have all of these nice sources here. This also used to be typewritten, by the way. But I have a very nice secretary who agreed to retype it for me. So now it's like all digital and I can mess around with it and move stuff in and out, which is really great. So if you dial back our tradition to its earliest layer, right? You go back to the time of the Bible. One of the things that's very hard for us to catch because it's so remote from our experience, is that in the biblical period, and here we're talking about, you know, roughly 1200 before the Common Era, 1100 before the Common Era, more or less, up to just before, you know, the time of Jesus, the turn of the Common Era. That's roughly a 1200-year period. For the first roughly 800 years of that, just 800 years, right? What we think of as the individual, right? Like the individual unique self that each of us understands ourself to be. It's kind of hard to imagine this, but it's not a concept that has emerged fully formed in the biblical period. Or to put this in really simple terms, we'll use this metaphor a lot this week and the next 2 weeks. You know, a contemporary mystical representation of God is, if God is the ocean, we are the waves. Right? This is a very popular mystical metaphor, that we think we're separate from the ocean because we see ourselves as the, but really, you know, if you understand it, the waves come from out there, they land here, they get pulled back out, and they merge back in. Okay, clear? For the biblical period, most responses to the problem of evil assume that there's only an ocean. They're kind of onto this already. And so as long as the ocean endures and is durable and will always be there, it's not as big a problem for them. What about my wave? Right? Like, you know, when you love somebody and they pass away, you don't just say, well, you know, we'll get another wave. You know, just stand on the beach, something else will come along, right? Or when you think about your own mortality, right? It's like something that we think about, you know, in Western traditions and religious traditions. We don't tend to think generically, you know, about human beings. We think very specifically about human beings, right? We don't think about humanity. We think about people. And when we think about people, we're thinking about individuals. But in the biblical period, that hasn't really fully emerged until pretty late. And we'll get to that tonight, because it surfaces with a vengeance in the book that you guys probably know is the one book of the 24 in the Hebrew Bible that exists to try to answer this problem, and that's the book of Job. Right? Now, Job is a pretty well-known character, right? But the book of Job is pretty late. I mean, it's written late in the biblical period, sometime around probably 300 before the Common Era. Now, that seems like a long time ago to us. It's 2,700 years ago. But since biblical writing has been going on for 800 or 900 years, by the time the person who writes Job writes that story down or makes that story up, could be the same thing. There's been a lot of other attempts to kind of come to this resolution. And what we'll also see, and just give you a little bit of context here before we look at the text, okay? Text and context. When you move into the rabbinic period, the rabbis of the Talmud, the Midrash, and remember, these are also the rabbis who basically create the liturgy. Not so much the prayer book, right? Because they don't have prayer books yet at the turn of the Common Era. They don't have printing presses, right? And everything's written out by hand, and it's an oral tradition. But the rabbis who shaped the liturgy, and our prayer book still looks a lot like what they shaped 2,000 years ago. So those rabbis, you know, from roughly, you know, the time of the turn of the Common Era, time of Jesus, up through around 500-600 of the Common Era, right? The rabbis who are recorded in the Talmud, the Midrash, the Mishnah, the collections of rabbinic writings, and the liturgy that we inherit later on as what's found in a book now, a prayer book, they inherit the entire biblical tradition just like we do. And because they live in a different time and place, they have to wrestle that tradition down because the answers that that tradition gives to the very disturbing problems of evil don't really work for them anymore. But they can't just say, well, that was then and this is now, so we don't need that anymore. Because one thing the Jewish tradition does is it carries into each incarnation whatever was created in the prior incarnation. We rarely leave anything behind, which is why the High Holiday Prayer Book is so heavy. Right? Because, you know, you add all these things, nobody ever takes anything out, right? And so we just have layer upon layer upon layer. So, again, I think you guys know this from being in a Reconstructionist synagogue and from the rabbis who are your teachers, but just to say it so it's transparent and on the table, the difference between what we do with the inherited tradition and what our ancestors did in the pre-modern versions of Judaism is they tended to do it in an unself-conscious way. So whereas we could say, well, some of the rabbis said this and some of the rabbis said that, you know, what really works for our time is this and not that. Or, you know, that text in the Bible that says children are punished for the sins of the parents, that seems like pretty inappropriate for our time. Whereas my confirmation class says the technical term is yucky, apparently. Pretty yucky for our time. But the rabbis inherit those words as words of the Torah. By the way, that passage, which we're going to come to in a couple of minutes tonight, that the children are punished on account of the transgressions of the parents, is actually in the Ten Commandments. Not the short version of the Ten Commandments, like over the ark, that's the, you know, the abbreviated, that's the hits of the Ten Commandments up there. But if you actually look in Exodus 20 at the text, right there in the text of, you know, Moses on Mount Sinai, you know, God is represented by the writers of the Torah. We can say that here without getting in trouble. Yeah. As saying that, you know, children suffer because their parents did something wrong. When the rabbis inherit that tradition, they say, that's not plausible. We don't believe that. But they can't simply say, like, we don't believe that anymore, because they would have no continuity. And also they believe the Torah is the word of God. We tend to look at the Torah as the accumulated writings of different biblical writers over a long period of time. And they represent different voices. The people around our table, the people around your Seder table, the people at your Thanksgiving table. Let's assume like it's your Seder table and most people are Jewish. Does that mean everyone agrees? Do I even have to answer this question? So, you know, we tend to think that religious traditions must have a kind of uniformity and unanimity around these big religious issues. And, you know, one of the really, I think, valuable pieces of the Reconstructionist tradition is this embrace of uncertainty and inexactitude, right? And this kind of appreciation of the diversity of Jewish responses, just like you would have around a Seder table. You know, you could ask 10 people the same question, you get different answers. And unless you're really invested in establishing which one is right and which 9 are wrong, which I don't recommend you do at your Seder, you know, there's something to be said for embracing the proliferation of different responses to this issue. Because we're on some level really talking about, you know, what works for people, what helps them work through the encounter with things that go wrong in their life. And so if you think of Judaism as a tool and a resource rather than as, you know, a set of beliefs and a doctrine that you ostensibly ought to agree and endorse, but you think of it rather as a tool or as a toolbox, even better, it's kind of nice to know that, you know, you'll forgive how banal this analogy is, but, you know, that screwdriver doesn't fit. Like, you dig a little deeper in the toolbox and, you know, you get another screwdriver. The good thing is, like, we have a lot of tools in the Jewish toolbox. So when you come to the question of evil, just like any religious question about God in our tradition, there's a variety of responses. I mean, we could do an adult ed class on the idea of mitzvah, commandment, right? There's like dozens of different interpretations of what does it mean that God commands something? What does that actually mean, you know, to us? And how do you separate commandment from custom? And who gets to decide? And, you know, how do you know what's really from God and what's really from people? And, you know, all of those difficult questions. So when we look at the problem of evil, just to wrap this up, we're looking at, you know, a kind of historical evolution, but we're going to look at it through conceptual categories. And we're looking at it transparently, like down through all the layers. So as an old piece of technology, remember those cellophane, those plastic sheets, right? You used to like lift one off or lay one over. So that's kind of how you have to imagine the Jewish tradition. Like we're kind of like peeling back the layers. And then what we inherit, you know, in 2018 is all of those transparency sheets, right? And you're trying to get down to the bottom to see, well, which one was first, right? And then you can kind of read them historically, like where do they appear? Why do they appear? When do they appear? You know, when do the old answers no longer become viable? And if you just pause for a minute, and I'll share this as my last piece of introductory work, you know, as I mentioned in my synagogue, I'm working with a confirmation class right now. One of the hardest things I've been working with them on is that what they're actually doing in 10th grade, you know, sophomore year, 16 years old, is they're actually not confirming anything. Right? What we're trying to get them to do is to question everything, not to confirm everything, right? So we're trying to get them to understand that the whole project of being a Jew at 16, 17, 18 is starting to separate, sort out what you've been told, what you've been taught, what you've been led to think you have to believe from what feels authentic to you. Not what you think your parents want you to believe or what you think the rabbis want you to believe. As you go through this stuff. So each of us who comes to the table tonight, and again, thank you guys for coming out, you know, we come with different stories, right? We have different ages, we have different biographies, we have different geographies we come from. Some of us might not come from Jewish backgrounds by way of family of origin. If we do, we come from different Jewish backgrounds. You know, some of us may have had a very early run-in with evil in our life, you know, or tragedy in our life at an early age. Other people, you know, don't have that until a much later age. You might have experienced loss at a very early age, but you might not have had a loss until much later in life. There's so many things, right? So many things that feed into what we all bring to the table. And so we're trying to read, you know, our collective tradition with appropriate respect for our individual experiences. And I hope that you'll feel free, you know, sharing whatever is appropriate and comfortable for you. Not so much by way of like, you know, self-help or self-disclosure, but, you know, just like what's resonant for you and what really is agitating and like if you feel like you have to say, like, I cannot believe that, like, one of the rabbis actually thought, like, that was a good answer to this, you know, so say that, right? Or, you know, the thing on this page that really works for me, you know, the thing that sounds most like where I am now is, like, you know, number two or whatever it is. Or, oh, yeah, like, when I was younger, I was, like, so on, like, number one. That's exactly what I thought. Or that's what my grandmother always told me, right? Or grandfather, right? Okay? Any questions about this stuff so far? All good? Okay. So let's start on page one, which seems like a good place to start. So the first category, just as a quick summary, I call collective culpability. And this is the idea that if one person within a covenantal community transgresses something, it affects the rest of the community in the eyes of God. And so it doesn't have to be that you did something wrong, but if your neighbor did something wrong, you may end up paying the price for that. Now, again, we'll look at some of these issues both theologically and, you know, anthropologically, by which I simply mean what may sound totally implausible from the point of view of explaining God can be totally plausible when you think of how life actually works. Mm-hmm. Right? So if I do something wrong, and that affects another person, and that affects another person, kind of like the domino effect. The idea that what one person does, other people somehow end up paying some price for that, doesn't sound quite so weird, right? Like if I, God forbid, I'm talking on the phone while I'm driving, which I never do, and you shouldn't either. Just sorry, I hate to be so blunt, but you shouldn't. And I run a red light and I kill somebody, you know, I'm obviously culpable. You know, like my action affects somebody else, but I haven't just killed that person. You know, everyone who knows that person is now affected by this person they've never met, namely me, the guy who ran the red light because I was busy on the phone. But when we look at this theologically, it sounds a little weirder. So here's a text from Deuteronomy, which probably sounds familiar to you. Comes at the end of the summer, but it's also one of the alternative high holiday readings for Yom Kippur morning in the Reconstructionist High Holiday Prayer Book. So this is the Nitzavim passage, right? It says, "You stand this day, all of you, before the Lord your God, your tribal heads, your elders, your officials, all the men of Israel, your children, your wives, even the stranger within your camp, from woodchopper to water drawer, to enter into the covenant of the Lord your God, which the Lord is concluding with you this day. I make this covenant with its sanctions, not with you alone, but both with those who are standing here with us this day before the Lord our God, and with those who are not with us here this day." So that's kind of the covenantal premise of the biblical version of Jewish tradition, right? What I like to call, and at least at RRC they used to call, the religion of ancient Israel. Which is, you know, the religion of ancient Israel is the religion of the Bible. The people who lived in the time of the Bible didn't have a term called Judaism. There was no Judaism, you know, in the time of the Bible by and large. It was like the religion of ancient Israel. But their religion was covenantal, it was communal, and it was transgenerational. So what the Israelites signed on to at Sinai when Moses brought them out of Egypt is binding on subsequent generations. Okay? In the same way, if you think about, you know, if you're a parent, and if you're not, you're at least a child, right? What you were given by your parents that wasn't, like, even your choice, was sort of handed to you and internalized and was part of who you were before you had any awareness of how it was getting inside of you, that's, like, the deal. Stuff is subscribed to by the people who come before us, and we inherit on some level, unless we totally step out of that tradition. We inherit the responsibilities that they signed on to that get transmitted to the next generation. So that's the premise. So what's an example of this? If you look in the citation B here, this is Numbers chapter 16, it says, "The presence of the Lord appeared to the whole community of Israel. The Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, 'Stand back from this community so I may annihilate them in an instant.' But they fell on their faces and said, 'O God, source of the breath of all flesh, when one person sins, will you be wrathful with the whole community?'" Right? So that's, you know, one of those stories in the Book of Numbers about somebody's, you know, doing something wrong. And, you know, the way that the person who wrote the story represents God is, God says, like, stand aside, Moses, while I wipe them all out, right? And what the, again, like, please put this Reconstructionist beat in the story, because remember, a Reconstructionist beat is traditional Jews say God says, and we say our ancestors say God says. Okay, is that part clear? Really crucial to read the text. Right. Whoever wrote the story has God say, you know, I'm going to wipe him out. And then whoever wrote the story has the people say, wait a minute, why should everyone get punished? Because one guy was, like, misbehaving. So you already see, like, some tension there. But if you go into citation 3, here's an example of an alternative view. The Israelites violated a ban. A guy named Achan of the tribe of Judah took which was proscribed. This is after one of the wars that Joshua wages. And the Lord was incensed with the Israelites. So I underline this. So you see, one person takes something they're not allowed to take. Right? This is the booty of war that is proscribed. And everyone gets punished. The Lord said to Joshua, Israel has sinned, plural, they have broken the covenant by which I bound them. Plural, they have taken things banned, they have stolen and broken faith. So that's, you know, I could have given you lots more citations, but this is pretty much the way the Bible deals, you know, in most of its writings with this issue. If something went wrong, what you've got to do is find the guy who's transgressed, who hasn't been exposed yet. If you can find that person, you'll know why we're all suffering. Okay? Doesn't mean, by the way, that you'll stop suffering, but at least you'll know why. Right? It's not my fault, it's not your fault. We got to find the guy who did something wrong. Within the biblical tradition, there are people who come back at this teaching and say, no, no way, don't believe it. So I'm jumping up to the book of Job and some of the Psalms. Just so if you're starting to feel like, Jesus, that's what the Bible says. I'm not sure that I like the Bible so much. So we have the book of Job, right? The book of Job, familiar to most people, you know, the basic setup of the book of Job. The beginning is Job is this guy who's like super prosperous, you know, and God. And so the author has like God and Satan up in heaven, and God says, wow, look at that guy Job. Man, he's really with me. He's like totally, like, he's for God. And Satan says, yeah, well, of course. I mean, if I had all the stuff he had, you know, I mean, look at his house, look at his car. His kids all got, you know, academic scholarships to Ivy League school. You know, he's got lifetime membership in his synagogue. He says, take some of that away and see what a faithful guy he really is. And the sad part of the story, of course, is that we know as the audience, it's like going to the theater, right? You know in the audience why this is happening. Job doesn't know what's happening. So God and Satan make this deal. Let's see what happens. So all these terrible things happen to Job, right? His fields and crops are destroyed. You know, his flocks are wiped out. His kids are taken away, right? I mean, it's really pretty awful. And then his friends show up. So you may remember this is like a trope in Western culture, Job's comforters. Have you ever heard that term? It's meant like cynically, like, you know, like the teenagers like Job's comforters, right? Meaning like comfort like this you don't need. Like Job's friend show up and say, oh, we feel so bad for you. You know, we're here to be, you know, what can we get for you? You know, is there any food you need? And then they're sitting with them, you know, and they start to say, so, Job, yo, what'd you do? I didn't do anything. Like Arlo Guthrie, right? And Alice's Restaurant. You know, what'd you do, kid? I didn't do nothing, you know? I had to got fine to pick up the garbage. They said, Job, you must have done something. Look how you're suffering. And then, like, you know, Job said, I didn't do anything. And, like, all the friends, like, go through the text I just read to. That's what it says. Like, you did something. Job said, I didn't do anything. And finally, it takes him 27 chapters to finally take on God. It's a long book. So that's where we are, number two. Citation 8, Job took up his theme and said, by God who has deprived me of justice, that's pretty direct, by Shaddai, another name for God, who has embittered my life, as long as there is breath in me and God's breath in my nostrils, my lips will speak no wrong or my tongue utter deceit. Until I die, I'll maintain my integrity. I persist in my righteousness and I will not yield. Meaning, you know, I'm not going to own up to having done something wrong. I haven't done anything wrong. I don't know why this is happening, but it's not happening because of anything I did. And I am not going to take the easy way out and say, I must have done something, I just don't remember what it was. Right? You know, like, it's like, you know, you ever get audited by the IRS, right? If you're lucky, it's a small mistake. So, you know, don't remember that mistake, but okay, I made a mistake. But Job said, I didn't do anything, and I'm not going to take the easy way out. I've got my own dignity, and I'm not going to just roll over. So this goes on, by the way, for another 11 chapters, okay, of Job protesting. And then some of you may remember, if you know the story of Job, in citation B, the Lord responds to Job out of the whirlwind. Answered is not a good translation here. It's really, it's a response. It's not an answer, as in why, okay? And God says to Job, according to the writer, who is this who darkens counsel, speaks without knowledge? Where were you, you insignificant little worm, when I laid the earth's foundations? Speak if you have understanding. Have the gates of death been disclosed to you? Have you surveyed the expanses of the earth? If you know of any of these, then tell me. So the response that Job gets is that God shows up. That's not insignificant. It's not a silence. Now, when we get to the third week and we start looking at, you know, post-Holocaust Judaism, the issue of silence becomes really significant, because that's what a lot of people experience around God after the Holocaust, is a sense of silence. But what the author of the book of Job gives us is God shows up. You're allowed to put God on the spot. God, you know, will give you a response. But the response is measured against the infinity of the universe and creation and the eternality of God and your small sojourn in this world as an embodied self for the 20, 30, 40, 60 years you may be here, you couldn't even begin to understand a glimmer of why things are the way they are. So the good news is you're not alone in the universe. There's some comfort and consolation in knowing there's something larger than what we are, at least according to this writer. And the challenging part is Job never gets an answer to why these things happened to him. Now, by the way, the writer at the end gives you a happy ending, which I really hate. You know, Job gets everything back that he lost doubled, right? You know, if he lost this many kids, he gets twice as many. If he lost this many sheep, he gets twice as much back, right? You know, if his investment portfolio dropped by 80%, it comes back by 160, right? So, I mean, this is a great ending. But he never knows that it's all a setup, that it's all a gamble, that it's all a cosmic kind of ploy between these two, you know, between Satan and God.
So this God here, this answer that God gives, response, it reminds me of the very end of the book of Jonah, where God says to Jonah, who are you to yell at me about this tree that's dying, this carob tree? You, I mean, practically says, you know, where were you? Yeah. I mean, it's the same. So I don't know if there's literally a relationship, but it's the same God.
Person,
who are you to who are you?
Yeah. I'm remembering where they date the book of Jonah, but I think it's relatively late as the books go. And you know the quirky thing about Jonah is that in Christian Bibles, he's one of the prophets. Mm. In our Bible, his book is in the writing section. It's in the third section. I hope I got that right. I think that's right, yeah. Yeah, and so does anyone know what's missing in the book of Job? What would, you know, it's in the traditional Jewish prayer book, but not in the Reconstructionist prayer book, about what happens after people die. And the author of the book of Job doesn't have that resource, which is the belief in resurrection.
Oh, yeah.
Now, that's a traditional Jewish belief. It hasn't arisen yet. Bad choice of words. hasn't arisen yet by the time the person who's writing the book of, because if it was available, it would have been like a really good answer to Job. God appeared out of the whirlwind and said, you couldn't begin to understand the meaning of, you know, your life in the context of the cosmos. But there's a life beyond this life in which this all gets set right. And you'll be with me, you know, in eternity, in heaven, whatever it is. And, you know, there's life eternal, and it's that life that gives your individual little sojourn in this world its real meaning, Job. But the author of the book of Job does not yet know that idea, because it hasn't been invented yet in Judaism. By the time the rabbis come around 200 years later, it's, and bad choice of words, but I always use it for resurrection, it's a live option. everyone knows, but so this whole story, you know, when I did the New Testament course, right, some of you guys were in that class. The whole premise of the story of Jesus being resurrected is that Jews believe people can be resurrected. If Jews don't think people can be resurrected, there's no point in Jesus being resurrected. I don't want to have a long digression, but we're coming up on Easter, right? So if you didn't take the New Testament class, here was the point of that whole 90-minute lecture.
Right?
Oh, my God. On one foot. Which is that Jews who choose not to follow Jesus don't not follow Jesus because his followers came up with this weird idea called resurrection. You know, it's not like the Jews say to Jesus' disciples, what? Like, what do you mean he was resurrected? What's resurrection? Where'd you get that crazy idea? They say, we believe in resurrection. We don't think your guy was the guy who was resurrected. That's why the Jews, by and large, don't follow Jesus. They don't believe he was resurrected. But I don't want to get too far into that. I just want you to see, you know, I jumped ahead for a bit here into Rabbinic Judaism. Just so you would have a snapshot of what's coming. See, I'm talking about the layering. So resurrection, right? The idea that bad things happen to people in this world, but there's a correlative recompense in the world to come, right? And that's an evolved tradition in Judaism, but it's not a voice of the Bible. The Bible doesn't know about resurrection, except for one quirky little reference in the book of Daniel. And the book of Daniel is super, super late. It's like, you know, around the time of the Maccabees, like 150. It's a good question, Andrea. The Kabbalistic tradition inherits the rabbinic invention. So the rabbinic part of Judaism invents the idea of resurrection. The Kabbalistic or the Jewish mystical tradition then takes the idea of resurrection and reinterprets it in one of two ways. One is what's called reincarnation, which we don't think Judaism has. We think Hindus have that, but Jews don't. But in Jewish mysticism, that's a pretty strong tradition of reincarnation, that souls come back and come back and come back. And that's where the term Gilgul, which means to circle through life, right, comes from. Which leads to, you know, there's a Yiddish expression, like, this isn't going to happen in this Gilgul, right? You know, which means it's not going to happen in your lifetime, right? And the other way that the Kabbalistic tradition, you know, I think deals with it, if I understand this correctly, is that it kind of separates the soul as this eternal thing from the body. Yeah. And so that's, and that, by the way, becomes the way modern Reform and Reconstructionist Judaism deals with the same issue of what happens after you die. Again, like, we don't have any official popes in, like, Reform and Reconstructionist Judaism, or in Orthodox, for that matter. But if you ask most liberal Jews, you know, a multiple choice question, like, what do you think happens after you die? Your body's resurrected, you live on in your relatives, your soul is eternal, or D, none of the above. I mean, when I do that, I usually get the soul is eternal. You know, it's, I think it's become sort of our default position.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, by the way, these are not mutually exclusive. They're not mutually exclusive. I mean, you do live on with your relatives, for better or worse. You live on in the lives of everybody who remembers your name. That's why, you know, in Jewish tradition, the tradition, like, you know, someone's name being a blessing, because when you say that name, you want people to think of, you know, what that person's attributes were, you know, what they contributed to the world. But it's a good question, and we'll deal a little bit, you know, in a week or two. We get to some of the mystical stuff, I hope, as we work through that. But I want you to have a pretty clear sense, at least of this first layer, that the biblical period, I'm going to back up, and I'm backing out of resurrection. So let's go backwards a little bit to when this idea hasn't been invented yet, okay? But if you had the idea of resurrection, the book of Job would have had a different ending. So instead of Job getting all his material stuff in this world, you know, reassigned to him, he can get it in the next world. Which is where the rabbinic tradition eventually will have to go. Anyway, it's not just the book of Job. There's a number of places in the Psalms where the people who wrote the Psalms, which, you know, the Psalms are basically poems, and they're not all written by King David. In fact, probably none of them are written by King David. That's the tradition. And the Psalms, you know, most of them, by contemporary research, seem to be relatively late. Like, you know, 500 to before the Common Era, up to, some of them are very old, but the ones that are later tend to reflect Job. So I just pulled, you know, random verses out of this, and I hate pulling things out of context. It really does a disservice, you know, to the poet, but you can look up the psalm later if you're interested. But just to give you some example, Psalm 73, the poet says, "It was for nothing that I kept my heart pure and washed my hands in innocence." I mean, why did I follow all the mitzvot? Why did I try to be a good person? Why did I do what was right? Because look, I'm constantly afflicted. Each morning brings more punishments. Mm-hmm. Now read that backwards, and what you've got is a theology of, if I do good, I should get good. Mm-hmm. So something's wrong here. I did good, and all I'm getting, like every morning I get up, it's like something else is going wrong.
Yeah.
Right? The power's not on, the heat's not on. You know, my cell phone's dying. I'm out of gas in the car to recharge my cell phone. You know, guys at Pico went home for the weekend. Like, nobody's coming. Or look at, that's the individual voice. Look at D, which is more of the collective voice. Why, O Lord, do you forever reject us? Why do you fume in anger at the flock you tend? How long, O Lord, will you ignore me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long will my enemy have the upper hand? So, again, like, there's lots of verses in the Psalms we could look at. I just wanted to get a snapshot of where our Bible ancestors, you know, also had a problem with God. And I don't know about you, but I take great comfort when my theological unsettlement, you know, when my theological issues feel, like, really unsettled for me, to know that, like, I'm not the first Jew who's having trouble with God, I find very comforting. I mean, I see these guys in the Psalms, and I think, like, you know, they could have been my next-door neighbors, right? They could have been living in our time. They could have been at the high school in Florida. Mm-hmm. They could have been in the hurricane in Texas, right? They could be Syrian refugees. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are not, like, ancient voices. These are contemporary voices. And notice this thing of how long will you hide your face from me? That's, like, that's the no response. Job at least gets a response. Like, you know, I was teaching some of this stuff to the 11th grade last year, and one of the kids said, you know, the one in Job sort of sounds to me like when my parents say, because I'm your father, that's why. I don't have to give you an answer. I just have to assert my authority, right? And that's one tradition. Anyway, in the prophets, you get some of the same problem. So, you know, I did a class here, and like 2 years ago, we did a lot of work on Jeremiah, right? We dug into Jeremiah. So it's helpful to know, when does Jeremiah live? Jeremiah lives roughly, you know, 620 before the Common Era, maybe a little earlier. He lives through the destruction of Jerusalem, the invasion of the Babylonians, the exile of the Jews. He sees real evil, and it's not individual, it's collective. Like, the nation is destroyed, the temple is burned down. Right, the hoi polloi are exiled off to Babylonia. It looks like the end of the Jewish story, right? And so Jeremiah, among the many things he says to God, "You will win, O Lord, if I make claim against you." Okay, I'm not disagreeing with you. You get to be God. But I'm still going to present charges against you. And Jeremiah, who speaks, you know, as a prophet, speaks the word of God, says back to God, "Why does the way of the wicked prosper? Why are the workers of treachery at peace?" Okay? So that's Jeremiah. So Jeremiah's name, by the way, in Hebrew either means God lifts up or God schmeisses down. So,
did Jeremiah get an answer?
No.
Mm-mm. Okay, just checking.
Yeah. No, nobody gets an answer here. I tell you, by the way, where our 3 weeks ends on the last page. Nobody ever gets an answer.
And it's interesting that seem to be okay with that.
Partly because the answer, well, so I should be more cautious. Answers are offered throughout Jewish tradition. None of them are convincing. And so we end up without an answer that really can respond to the problem of why do bad things happen in the world, you know, to deserved people who, you know, to undeserving people. Why do innocent people suffer? Why do people, like, you know, even if you do cause and effect, this because of that, does not explain, you know, like, an infant who dies. Like, what could an infant have done?
Mm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's what happens at the end, you know, we get to some of the contemporary stuff. We get to Rabbi Harold Kushner. You remember his book, right? When Bad Things Happen to Good People. Just to jump ahead a bit, because it's a really valuable question. I know I've said this at Beth Israel before. The title of the book is not Why Bad Things Happen to Good People. Yeah, and Kushner makes a really deliberate point about this. You can find him on YouTube explaining this, you know. He says, you know, because the why question is kind of a pointless question. said, for him, religion is not about explaining why things happen. It's responding to the things that happen. Right? And so when bad things happen to good people, what do you do? I think, you know, is kind of like a more paradigmatic Jewish question. So as you guys know, I'm sure, from personal experience, on both sides of the experience, when somebody dies and people go to pay a shiva call, they don't come to explain why, you know, the person died. I mean, I hope not. Right? And sometimes people stumble through that because they're trying to be helpful in an awkward situation, you know, like, you know, God, you know, the person's with God now, or, you know, the even worse one, like God needed your fill in the blank in heaven more than you needed him, her, here. People don't mean to be cruel. I mean, I understand why they say stuff like that. But by and large, when you come to a shiva call, you're just coming to be with somebody. You're not coming to give them a theology lesson. In the same way that when you make a hospital call as a chaplain or a rabbi, you know, like, it's not the place for a theology lesson. Like, you are with people. You try to comfort them, support them, strengthen them. Those are responses.
Witness.
Yeah. Responses and answers, you know, are very different kinds of things. And again, like, I'm telegraphing some of where we go, you know, the next 2 weeks, but I think the thread that modern Jews pull through our tradition, through all of its layers, is the trope of response. And kind of intellectually, the trope of answers is interesting, but is not always satisfying. Okay? Anything else on page one you guys want to tackle? And go on to page two? Good. So I don't do all the reading and I don't have to do all the talking. Would someone like to read at the top of the page, F, I am the Lord?
With the microphone, please.
Go for it.
Now you're going to sound like the Lord if you use the microphone. You're like,
oh, Rich has that voice.
Well, we've got a recording and we've got hearing issues and yeah, we'll try to have it. We out of batteries.
Oh, well.
Oh, there we go.
I think Andrea said she would read.
Oh.
Yeah.
I am the Lord, and there is none else. I form light and create darkness. I make real and create woe. In the prayer book, the rabbis change woe to evil, to all things. I, the Lord, do all these things.
Okay, thanks, Andrea. So this passage, Isaiah chapter 45, we're looking at a biblical prophet who lived maybe 50 years after Jeremiah. Some of you know that there's more than one Isaiah. The book of Isaiah chapter 1 through 39 is the Isaiah who lives around 720-700 BCE. The guy whose writings are in chapter 40 to the rest of the book lives in Babylonia around 550. How those writings got put together, nobody knows. But they're clearly very different people. So you guys know this, I hope, from the prayer book. It's in the morning service. Right after you do the Baruch Hu Ed Adonai HaMbarach, Baruch Adonai HaMbarach Elam Va'ed, Baruch Atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech Olam, Yotzer Or Uvorei Choshech, Oseh Shalom Uvorei Et HaKol. That's this verse. So, Andrea, the part you were reading, that in the italics and the parentheses, when the rabbis migrate this verse from the Bible into the liturgy, they do something pretty audacious. Just so you know, Mordecai Kaplan wasn't the first person to change the prayer book. They take Isaiah's word. Remember, Isaiah is a prophet of God. He's saying the words of God. The rabbis say, eh. You know, and they redline it, right? Like, they edited it out. And they change the idea that Isaiah says, I'm God, there's none else, I make light and dark, I make good and evil. That's what Isaiah says. When that verse lands in the prayer book, the rabbis change, I make light and dark, and I do everything. And they get rid of good and evil. Which means by the time the rabbis were assembling the liturgy, they were already troubled by how odd that verse sounded. Because what did the rabbis, what did they just live through? The destruction of the Second Temple and the invasion of the Romans, right? And then the rise of Christianity. So, you know, the rabbinic tradition comes out of a really traumatic period in Jewish history. It's a period of dispersion and inconsistency and uncertainty. And that's the formative period of what we call Judaism. So just think about that for a minute, right? Think about the people, think about, you know, children who spend their adolescence, their formative years, in a situation of trauma, uncertainty, you know, need, want, moving from place to place. And then they finally settle someplace as they now become adults. Well, that's like their context for coming of age. That's going to be with them the rest of their lives. It's formative for them in the way that an individual experience for any one of us is formative for us. So, you know, if, for example, just to give you my own experience, you don't have to share yours. So, like, I had the experience of the death of a parent at a very young age. Like, my dad died just before I turned 11. You know, my wife's parents and my mother-in-law, 101, still going. Yeah, really. You know, she's like the bionic woman. And, like, you know, her dad died when he was, like, in his 80s. So my wife doesn't have the same experience, right? It's not better or worse. It's just different, right? So it very much shapes, you know, the rest of my life. But derivatively, it influences my kids and influences their kids. But it's not the same experience. But if you come out of that experience, as our Judaism comes out of it, it's just a helpful thing to keep in the back of your mind. It's not like, you know, we inherited Judaism. It was written during a period of plenty and stability and certainty, you know, and security. You know, our tradition is formed in one of the most disruptive periods of Jewish history. And that can't help but filter into the Judaism we inherit in the Talmud and in the prayer book and in the Midrash. Because that's the world that the rabbis live in. They can't live in any other world.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Is it possible also that this changing of the language was a response, a polemic to dualism?
To a dualism.
Yeah.
Well, the original verse of Isaiah is understood to be a polemic against Zoroastrianism by most scholars, which probably means it's not true, but most scholars think it's true. But what they think is that the Jews get exiled from Judea, they land in Babylonia. And, you know, if you're Jewish and you're saying, like, how did we end up here? And someone says to you, you know, have you thought about maybe their God's stronger than our God? That sounds kind of like a plausible explanation for why we're sitting in Babylonia. And so prophets like Isaiah come along to say, you know, there's one God, light and dark, good and evil. That's a polemic. What's interesting is that in the rabbinic version of it, where they change the words Andrea read in the parentheses, the polemic drops out. Right? I'm God, I create light and dark. Yeah, we know that. Morning, evening, that's easy, right? good and evil, no. It's like gone, right? And that tells you that, like, for the rabbinic tradition, they were troubled by this stuff, and they could not just carry it over, you know, as whole cloth from the earlier generations. Okay? So let's go on to the third version of Jewish response to this, is generational guilt. So generational guilt is one step off from cause and effect in one generation. So Achan, the guy in the book of Joshua, he steals some of the booty from the people that the Israelite army has wiped out. You're not allowed to do that. The stuff's contaminated. It's got bad karma. It's like kryptonite, right? My Bible professor used to say, you know, bring kryptonite, you know, into, you know, Superman's house, you're in trouble. So generational guilt takes the same idea of cause and effect. This happened for a reason. But instead of saying it happened, you know, something you did or something that someone near you did, it becomes something that someone before you did. It takes the idea of cause and effect and it makes it generational. So I already anticipated this with you, so I'm going to go through this part, you know, fairly quickly because we read some of these already. Would someone like to read the A section and the B section? Who's got the microphone?
Oh,
okay, Richard. Okay, well, that, so you can either read or you can pass on to someone else.
Anybody?
All right. You're elected.
Section A?
Mm-hmm. 3A, for I the Lord.
For I the Lord your God and an impassioned God, visiting the guilt of the fathers upon the children, upon the third and upon the fourth generations of those who reject me, but showing kindness to the thousandth generation of those who love me and keep my commandments.
Okay, so this is the Ten Commandments section that I mentioned to you. And this is the doctrine, it's called in Hebrew, Poked Avon Avot Al Banim. The children pay for or paying off the sins of the fathers. Now, I don't know if any of you guys are in a profession that works this way, but when I taught this at my shul in the fall, a couple of the lawyers there said that they deal with this, you know, in wills. Mm. You know, like if people die in debt, the debt isn't necessarily erased. You know, the children inherit an estate, and part of that estate goes to settle the debt. So as an economic thing, it sounds so weird. I mean, someone's got to pay off the debt. So as a theological concept, it may have some analogy to that, okay? But we'll see as we get down this page, and we will definitely get through this page, because I don't want you to go home thinking this is what Judaism teaches, because it's not, okay?
It's also, I think, a psychological study that says that certain traits actually become part of the DNA and have to pass on.
Yeah, this is one of those interesting things of contemporary neuroscience research, right? That's something that my wife spends a lot of time reading about, intergenerational trauma. Like, where does collective Jewish trauma live in individual Jewish lives? How is it passed on and transmitted? And whether it's genetic or it's culturally encoded or some interaction of those two.
But there's a study that, in fact, changes the DNA.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah,
yeah. The problem with the studies, you know, is always that there's a study that then says that study's wrong. But it's the, you know, I think it's the nature of studies. But my niece, who's the neuroscientist in our family, is a great resource to me. I can, like, call her up and say, so did you hear about the study I read about in the paper? And then she could tell me, like, you know, where it stands, you know, in said that there is some evidence of this stuff. So in that sense, again, remember what I said to you, like, about 40 minutes ago. When you think of this stuff on an anthropological human level, it doesn't sound so weird. It's when you think of it on the theological level that it starts to sound a little bit more challenging. Like, why is God, like, you know, punishing my kids for my transgressions? I should, like, pay off my transgressions, right? But when you think of it as something that parents inevitably pass on, I mean, it's, you know, it's hard not to. Then it doesn't sound so weird. Yeah.
Yeah, I think because we live in this sort of liberal, progressive society where we like to think that we need ourselves and that our children will make themselves, that it becomes hard to live with this almost dark sense that there's this stuff that gets passed down from generation to generation. But mm-hmm. if you look at it, it's kind of glaring, but there's no reason why it wouldn't.
Yeah, yeah. And also the things that whether we inherit them and encode them genetically or, you know, we're enculturated into them or likely some mix of those two things, you know, the way that we're formed before we're even, like, verbal, you know, as you know, as infants and whatever else it is. There's so many things that are givens that are contextual, you know, and just think, you know, the way that the way that contemporary culture uses, you know, situated as a word, privilege as a word. Like, you know, if you're born, you know, white and middle class in a certain kind of neighborhood, you know, you can kind of, and if you're not, there's other kind of trajectories. It doesn't mean, like, other stuff doesn't matter. It just means that there's so many things that already determine so much. What my niece tells me, you know, in the terms of the neuroscience stuff that's really, I think, helpful around the DNA stuff also, is that, you know, the discoveries right now of how plastic are neurons in our brains are throughout our life, that even though we're formed in some ways, we're not necessarily hardwired. You can kind of as my niece said, what's the phrase they use? The neurons that fire together wire together. So if you, like, this is like the meditation studies, the stuff that I've been reading the last couple of years. They study people who do, like, a lot of meditation. They kind of recut their neural grooves, you know? Cognitive behavioral therapy, for any of you who know about that or maybe in that or, you know, on either side of either you practice it or you work with it, is sort of based on the same thing. You can rewire the way that you respond to stimuli, right, is the whole premise of cognitive therapy. So if you're the kind of person who always gets angry and yells at a certain provocation and you say, that's just the way I am, the neuroscientists say, only if you want to stay that way. Right? You want to be different, it takes some work to recut your neural pathways, but you can do it. Right? That's the plasticity. Which, to me, by the way, is so Jewish. it's like the message of Yom Kippur. The way it's been does not have to be the way it will always be. You get to make some choices here. That's like, to me, like the whole message of the High Holidays. Otherwise, it would be a pretty depressing experience, right? And you're going to come and say, yeah, I'm a pretty bad person. I'm probably going to be worse next year. Why come back? You know? But the whole idea that, you know, what has been is not necessarily a forecast of what will be. Right? It's the whole premise of so much of Jewish moral development.
It's sort of like the parental Jewish curse. I only hope you have children. Just like
you. Yeah. Right. Anyway, I'm going to skim a little bit of this because I'm trying to keep track of the time. I don't want to push it beyond 9 o'clock because it's cold and it's, you know, the end of the week and you'll be sleepy and, yeah, then you'll have to pretend to be polite and you won't think that I know what time it is. So I'm going to skip B. Maybe we'll come back to it next week. Don't just give me a couple of other things here, generational guilt. Book of Lamentations, which is contemporary with Jeremiah and the destruction of Israel and the exile to Babylonia. Our fathers sinned and are no more, and we must bear their guilt. Mm. I mean, that's Lamentations only 5 chapters. Oh. So it comes towards the end, right? You read it on Tisha B'Av in the summer. Okay? Now, the Torah in Exodus chapter 20, in the Ten Commandments, no less, says God punishes the children for the sins of the fathers, of the ancestors. Along comes Jeremiah and Ezekiel, right, who are contemporaries. Okay, Jeremiah and Ezekiel live at the same time. We don't think they knew each other, but they live at the same time. Jeremiah says in chapter 31, in those future days, they shall no longer say, fathers have eaten sour grapes and children's teeth are blunted. Mm-hmm. Contemporary version. You gave your kid too much sugary juice and you were going to pay for the orthodonture. Right? but rather, Jeremiah says, everyone dies for their own sins. Whoever eats sour grapes, his teeth shall be blunted. So you get it. This is a metaphor or an analogy, right? And the analogy is, parents eat bad fruit, kids have rotten teeth. Kids are paying for the sins of the parents. Jeremiah, a prophet of God, right, says, not in the future. That's not going to be the way stuff is anymore. And not only Jeremiah says that, but Ezekiel says the same thing, a little bit more expansively. Ezekiel says, the person who sins, he alone shall die. So that guy Achan in the time of Joshua who stole the booty, he'll get punished, but not everybody else. Right? Lamentations say, our father sinned, we're getting punished. Not anymore. Says, a son shall not share that, shall not share the burden of a father's guilt, nor shall a father, this is good to know, share the burden of a son's guilt, right? Runs in both directions. The righteousness of the righteous is accounted to that person alone. The wickedness of the wicked is accounted to that person alone. Moreover, if the wicked person repents of all the sins he committed and keeps God's laws and does what is just and right, he will live and not die. That's the doctrine of Teshuvah, mm-hmm, right? Which is, again, like a developing doctrine. It's not like it comes down from Sinai. Teshuvah evolves over time, and we did this class also some years ago. The big question of Teshuvah is, so you say you're sorry and like, now everything's okay? Yeah, everything's okay. There's an episode of All in the Family, by the way, in the same line, right? Archie Bunker says, and that's it. Like, nobody suffers, right? And if you remember that episode, he says, yeah, nobody suffers. Let's eat. So, it's a great little episode. You can look it up online. Ezekiel ends, none of the transgressions he committed shall be remembered against him. Because of the righteousness he has practiced, he will live. And then he says rhetorically, is it my desire that a wicked man should die, says God? It's rather he should turn back, same word, shuv, from his ways and live. So Jeremiah and Ezekiel, who are living through the destruction of Jerusalem, the exile to Babylonia, say two things. One is the story's not over, we're going back, very important, as we talked about in the class I did a couple of years ago here. And they say, and it's going to be a different setup with God. It might have been the case that once upon a time, the reason bad things happened to good people was because other people did stuff or their parents' generation did stuff. Not anymore going forward. Everyone's accountable for their own stuff. Right? Nobody's going to pay for someone that, something they didn't do. Again, like good news and bad news, right? I mean, if you're an innocent person and you got schmeiced, you at least say, I guess my parents were, you know, paying, did something bad. Now you get schmeiced and you're back to Job. What did I do? So we're still kind of stuck in the cause and effect model, which is, again, the question of, does anyone ever come up with an answer for this?
And you said something earlier that we don't throw anything out. We just keep adding. Mm-hmm. And yet, it seems like, on the one hand, at one point, we had the collective, and then here we've got more of the individual guilt.
Mm-hmm.
And there, he is saying, no, we're going to throw that one out. We're going to do this one instead.
Mm-hmm. And the way that they get around that is by saying it once was the case, but it won't be in the future because God's changing the plan, God's changing the setup. So the way they get around it, they don't say it was never true. That was a false idea that found its way into the Bible through the teachings of some guy that we don't agree with anymore. They can't say that. What they say is it used to be that way, but it won't be that way going forward.
Because God changed his mind.
God's setting it up differently, yeah.
Okay.
And are they talking about...
Now, by the way, that...
See how that gets around.
Well, it doesn't make what came before wrong. It makes what came before obsolete. That's different. Being wrong and being obsolete are two different problems. If it's wrong, then God... Either those people weren't prophets, or Moses got the wrong Ten Commandments, or someone stuck something in there by mistake when they hit cut and paste... Right.
But obsolescence is the opposite of accretion. I mean, you talked about that, that we add, I think Debbie was asking that if we add to everything, then how can some concept become obsolete?
Because you put another transparency, or I mean, to use my analogy, you put another transparency over it, and the one that's on top is the one that's governing.
So the other thing is still part of the tradition, but it's
kind of like, it's like any case, I don't know anything about legal stuff. I mean, what I know is really amateur, but my understanding of the way the Supreme Court is supposed to work or used to work or maybe could work is that when a ruling comes down, it becomes a precedent and things going forward have to take account of that. Right. Now, does that mean that like what was like, is the Dred Scott decision wrong or obsolete? Well, now, you might say both. Okay, no, I understand. Because that's where the analogy breaks down, because it's a humanly constructed civil process. Mm-hmm. But when it's the revealed word of God, which Reconstructionists, by the way, wouldn't say, but okay, the tradition says it is, it's a little harder to say God made a mistake, God was wrong, or that guy wasn't a prophet. I mean, you're into like this theological layer where as soon as you say one thing might not be true, that's the slippery slope. Right? As soon as you say, you know, like that part of the Torah... You know, about stoning suspected adulteresses. Yeah, that part's not true. You know, then how do you know the other stuff is true? Well, the stuff we like is true. The stuff we don't like is not true. Right? Well, that's, it's a human thing. That's the way that we read the tradition, you know?
In some ways, you're saying the truth is not as relevant as relevance.
Yeah.
Truth is not as important as relevance.
That's an interesting question. Yeah. If I reframed it slightly, I would say that, like, you know, philosophical consistency in religion is less important than having a good pastoral toolbox. I'm less interested as a rabbi personally in answers to these questions as I am in what are the resources in Jewish tradition that can help people through these moments. Because honestly, I wouldn't know an answer that would work for me. I mean, I found this out when I was 11. There is no answer to my question. And as God says to Job, if I gave you an answer, would you feel better? Is there like an answer that would really make you feel better about this? And, you know, it takes a while to realize that there probably isn't. And it takes a kind of religious maturity, by the way, which comes to some people earlier, some people later, to sort of accept that, you know, we may never know some of these things. By the way, you know, there's a place in religion for faith and for trust. And I don't mean to underestimate that. I was going to do that in the third week, but you know, you might not all be here the third week, so I don't want you to go home depressed. And it may be that, you know, you find in the pastoral toolbox of Jewish tradition certain beliefs in God's care, judgment, righteousness that are comforting, you know, that give you a sense of trust and faith and help you get through. I'm not trying to take that away by any means. But I think that that's an individual choice that people make. The same answer that gives one person great comfort in the hospital makes the person in the bed next to them crawl. Like, get me out of this room. Right? Oh, hello, I'm Rabbi So. Would you like, could I spend a few minutes with you? And not if you're going to say to me what you just said to her. Right? You know? And sometimes it's exactly what they want to hear. And that, of course, you know, tells us about the subjectivity of religious experience. The same answer that Job finds comforting, someone else finds infuriating. It tells you nothing about the answer. It tells you something about those two people. Why does that one person find that plausible? Or, you know, why do people find mysticism or Kabbalah like to be their trope or their entry point to Jewish tradition? Other people say, I don't understand any of that Kabbalistic stuff. I don't get any of that. It makes no sense to me. You know, because what resonates for us is a product of everything we bring to that moment. Right? And part of the evolving Jewish civilization that Reconstructionism speaks about is not just like out there, it's in each of us, right? I mean, what am I telling you that you don't know? It's much harder to explain to my 16-year-old confirmation students. So I say to them, like, what did you think about God when you were six? I say, they can't remember six. I say, okay, 10. And now you're 16, and can you imagine what you might think about God when you're 26? Like, 10 years from this year's confirmation, what are you going to think about God? And the kids, if they're honest, say, I don't know. I said, okay, here's an easier one. Do you think it'll be the same thing you think now? And they all say no. Mm-hmm. There isn't a kid in my class, 20 kids, who says, I'll think the same thing. By the way, I think this is good. Because they're sort of prepared, you know, to keep growing in their stuff. Anyway, that's in my sermon for the night. So here's the layering and the accretion issue. So I brought you two texts from the Talmud now. So I'm jumping ahead. From Ezekiel, citation E, Ezekiel, you know, 590, 570 BCE, to the Talmud in the tractate Makot is probably about 700 years. We're jumping 700 years. Maybe 800 years between citation E and F. But I want you to see how the rabbinic tradition dealt with this problem of the teeth and the grapes, right? Intergenerational guilt. So, Rabbi Yossi ben Hananiah says, Moses made four declarations, and then four prophets came and annulled them. Whoa! This is the same Moses, right? The end of Deuteronomy, the last book of the Torah, the last page of the Torah, right? Last panel in the scroll. There never arose a prophet in Israel like Moses who knew God face to face. Pretty definitive. The rabbis say, yeah, until, you know, the prophets came along and annulled what Moses said. Whoa! That's pretty heavy stuff. Of these four, the fourth was Ezekiel. Because look, Moses said God visits the sin of the fathers on the children. You saw that text above. Ezekiel came and annulled the assertion and says the soul that sins, that soul alone shall die. So, you know, the rabbis of the Talmud are saying, you know, the prophets had the ability to annul what came before. Now, by the way, for those of you who like to think about this stuff politically, what do the rabbis gain from that little interpretation? Because they're in charge now. And therefore, we, the rabbis, we get to change stuff too, and you have to listen to us. Because there's a precedent, right? This, by the way, you know, solidifies their authority, right? This is like an interesting political discussion, but that's a whole other conversation. Okay, the other citation from the Talmud, it says in Deuteronomy chapter 24, children shall not be put to death for the fathers. Each person shall be put to death for his own sin. By the way, it means that Deuteronomy and Exodus don't agree.
Yeah.
Okay. But it says in Exodus chapter 20, there you go, God visits the sins. What's the answer of the Talmud? That means God only visits the sins of the fathers on the children if the children behave like the parents. Mm-hmm. That's their way out. That's one rabbinic way out of this issue. If the children persist in bad behavior, right? This is, I've never seen this movie, by the way, but I know a lot about The Godfather, right? Mm-hmm. And there's a whole fight over who's going to succeed Marlon Brando. I forget the name of his character. Who does he play?
Don Corleone.
Don Corleone. There you go. stuff just spooks me. All right. So if you persist in behaving like that, then you will, according to this, suffer the same way. You know, if you step out of the family and become a priest, you got a chance of like beating the generational guilt or the DNA thing that Andrea pointed to earlier.
Rich? Another line that's relevant from that, which is when Michael Corleone says, "Just when I was getting out, they pulled me back."
Yeah.
In other words, this generational karma is hard to break, because that second film is all about him trying to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. But you can see what's emerged here, and I think one of you mentioned this about 10 minutes ago, and it's a good place to start to pull this together for tonight. What emerges by the rabbinic period is this sense of the wave and not the ocean. And if the concern of the Bible period, and this is really unfair to be this black and white and blunt about this, but in very simple terms, if the Bible period is really worried about the ocean, the rabbinic period is really worried about the waves. Because by the time you get to the rabbinic period, the idea of the unique individual self, that's you and you and you and you, you arrive in the world, you know, born at a certain time and place, you live this embodied existence in your culture and your time, and you leave this world, right? This body, like, stops functioning. That individual unique self that will never be like any other self that'll be in the world. It might be similar, but it's never going to be the same. What happens to that wave? By the time the rabbinic period comes along, that's the focus. That's the focus. And therefore, all of this biblical stuff that's about the ocean and not about the waves is not going to be helpful to them. They don't want to know that it's okay, the Jewish people will live on. Right? Unfortunately, you live through the Babylonian Empire's invasion of Judea, but the Jewish people will live on. Oh, I feel much better now. Right? But that's their position on this stuff. By the time you get to the rabbinic period, that's not their position. They're much more concerned about the life of the individual. And so, you know, if you're here next week, but if you're not, it starts on page 3. Just so you know what's coming, in case you can't be here next week. We're going to look next week at the issue of consequence. In other words, the rabbis inherit from the writers of the Bible the idea of cause and effect. Something bad happens, there must have been a cause for it. But they eventually come to the position of, actually, not all the time. There are some things we simply can't explain with that. And answer responsibly, they throw up their hands. They say, there is no answer to that. Now, the rabbis of the Talmud could say that, then, you know, you at least have good partners. Then we'll look at what's called the chastisements of love, which some of you may remember as, this hurts me than it hurts me more than it hurts you, right? Well, that's one rabbinic response. It's like, you know why you're suffering? Because God loves you more than everybody else, right? And God is concerned to, like, you know, whip you into shape. God wouldn't do that if God didn't care about you. For some of the rabbis, by the way, that helps them, you know, get through this stuff. For other people, it's like, you've got to be kidding, right? So we'll look at that tradition. That's on page 3 and 4. And then we'll move on to the evil inclination. Why is there evil in the world? Because we got these two things that are fighting their way out within us. And then by the end of next week, we'll be at the bottom of page 5, which I already did an overture for you tonight. That's the idea, not just of resurrection, but there's a world after this world. That's where I'm going to stop, okay? Just by telling you in one sentence that the traditional Jewish idea that we have of the last 2,000 years of what's called in Yiddish the Olam Haba, or the Olam Haba, the world to come, the Bible doesn't know anything about it. For the Bible, there's this world, there is no other world. For the rabbinic period, this world is just, it's the hallway out there into the main event, which is in here. You've got temporal individual life, and you've got eternity. And the rabbis basically invent this idea. They invent this idea of a world to come after you die. And it's not part of biblical Judaism, but it's a part of rabbinic Judaism. And so we inherit it as part of what we inherit until the 19th century, when the Reform movement says, actually, we don't believe in that anymore. And then you get Mordecai Kaplan, and this has been exactly 9 o'clock. We end with Mordecai Kaplan, who in the Reconstructionist, you know, version of stuff says the religion of the Bible was a this-worldly religion. The religion of the rabbis and the Talmud in the medieval period and the Kabbalah was an otherworldly religion. And the religion of Jewish modernity is back to a this-worldly religion. And that's Mordecai Kaplan's version of how you work this stuff out. And so everything that has to do with some other supernatural world beyond the one we can see, you know, for modern liberal Jews, kind of drops out as a main focus of things. And so you get, you live on through your kids, you get your, the soul is eternal, but you don't get resurrection, you don't get heaven, you don't get all the supernatural overlay. And then, you know, if you're not here the next 2 weeks, you'll read through if you'd like, or you can listen to the recordings. And then we'll get to the contemporary period and Harold Kushner and some of, and just since you raised it, like the last couple of pages have some of the stuff from Kabbalah through modern refractions of stuff here through Larry Kushner's writings about some of those things. And what I'll try to end with is just, you know, of all the stuff we look at here, you reach into the Jewish toolbox, what seems like it's appropriate for the 21st century? I mean, what are we teaching our kids? What are we saying to each other? What are we saying at funerals? You know, how are we dealing with this issue today? You know, what in Jewish tradition can we bring forward that could really work now? And the converse of that, what are we leaving in the toolbox? Because, you know, it worked for other people. It really doesn't work for us. And that's, you know, part of the post-Holocaust conversation that we'll take a look at next couple of weeks, okay? Anyway, thank you guys for coming out. God willing, the weather will not be a problem for the next 2 weeks. But if you're not certain, and if it had been yesterday today, if the weather of yesterday had been today, and Marion, there's a question for you, and people needed to know if we're going to be here, how do they know that? Do they call you? I mean, is there something posted on the website? I just don't know.
Yeah, I've sent it out. I mean, we'll get 3 voicemails from Joyce and Chris. And
I just want to be sure because. And I just wanted to be sure because I wouldn't hate for you guys to show up.
No, you'll be able to tell. We'll let you know. I have a couple other things to say.
We're hoping that this has not become a problem.
I have now learned that I will ask Diane on Thursdays to turn the heat on before she leaves. Sorry about that tonight.
You have to send an email to Chris because there's a lock on there.
I told him that on the telephone. He said, no.
Well,